Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 259, and we're going to talk about that van that you've been dreaming of, that van that you've been building out, that van that you finished. Well, it isn't going to last. We're also going to talk about a place to visit that is one of the scariest things I can think of, at least when I was a kid, a resource recommendation that will help you and maybe help others, and a tale from the road involving a scamp. Well, folks, welcome back. You have survived long enough to listen to yet another episode of Jeff Gaps to, of Built to Go. Yes, thank you for being here. My life is crazy and in constant upheaval, and we need to have a talk about that. And that involves you and me and some harsh realities that we need to face. And it's not as bad as it sounds, but it is a definite trend. And that trend is that nobody is ever satisfied with their van, or their truck camper, or their trailer, or the car they're sleeping in, or their tent, or whatever. There is something wrong with us. All right, I'll speak just for myself. But I can't, because look at those YouTube people that you have been watching for years and notice that they don't keep their vehicle very long. Now, there are exceptions, of course. Some van life people will keep their vans forever. Some of them will have them for 30 years, but not that many. Look at Bob Wells. He was in a box truck, then he was in a van, then he was in another van, and then he was in an ambulance, and then he was in a little tiny car, and then, oh no, wait, and then he's building out a trailer. And then Nate from Element Van Life started off in, strangely enough, an Element, and then he was in a van, and then he was in another van, and then he was in a truck camper, and another truck camper, and he didn't like that, so he built another truck camper. And he's doing something else now. He's building out a van. I don't know actually if it's his or not. F&A Van Life, who we were actually on this show a while ago, they're in a completely different situation now. When we talked on this show, they were in their second van that they'd built out in Costa Rica. And now they apparently have bought some land in Canada, and they're building out a utility trailer after having refurbished one of those micro campers with the Toyota front. And how many years has it been? Now, I've only been doing this podcast for 5 years, and that's the pattern. That's the pattern for almost every YouTuber, and it's probably going to be your pattern too, and it's my pattern as well, and that's actually what we need to talk about, because I feel a bit like a fraud. I'm going to come clean here, folks. I'm just going to state it flat out. I'm doing a van life podcast, but I'm not doing van life currently. I mean, okay, I am. I do spend a lot of time in RVs and vehicles camping, but it's on my own property, and it's not quite the same thing. How did this happen? Well, it's not from lack of interest. I absolutely want to get on the road. This all started when I had this surgery at the beginning of the year, and that just laid me up for months and months and months. And that led to my van, my 2011 Sprinter 2500 ambulance, sitting and not being started for months. This is a bad thing for these vans. I tell you right now that if you have a Sprinter, you definitely want to at least start it every 2 weeks. I couldn't. I couldn't walk, never mind drive, to get to the van and start it. My van cannot be with me in Chicago. It has to be parked far away in LaSalle County, which is at the very minimum a 90-minute drive, which I couldn't do. So it sat all winter, and I made all the preparations I could. I stabilized the diesel fuel, I disconnected the battery, I did everything. And when I went back there, finally, I finally got to my van, and you remember I told a story about how I went all the way down there and forgot the keys. Well, when I finally got in the van, I started it up, and it started right up. I thought, that's great. And I had about 90 seconds of thinking everything was okay. And then the check engine light came on. And since then, I have spent every weekend trying to get the van out of limp mode. And I can't. It's beyond me. It's throwing so many codes at me that I don't even know where to start. And the problem really is that this van is now in LaSalle County, which is a fairly rural part of the state, at least compared to Chicago. I can't find anyone to work on it. I can't find anywhere to take it. The one place I had been using that had a tech that had one of these Sprinters, this is too much for him. He says it needs to go to a diesel tech. And the diesel techs down there laugh at these vans. They work on big rigs, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And even if I had time to do van life right now, I don't have a van that I can do van life in. Yes, I can drive it around my measly 4 acres, and I can camp in the woods, or I can camp next to the river, or I can camp in the driveway. Yeah, so you might sense a touch of frustration in my voice. And so what is the solution? Well, I have to get that van fixed, no matter what, whether I keep it or sell it or whatever. I have to get the van fixed. But that's a problem I can't spend time on right now because I have so many other things going on. I've got the trip to Norway and Belgium and Scotland and London that I have to plan for. That's coming up June 21st. I'm taking a totally different group of people through the Bermuda Triangle on July 7th. And my wife and I are going on a trip at the end of this month, and she richly deserves that trip, so there's nothing going to get in the way of that. I've got all that going on right now, and I won't go into too much detail, but something has happened that is requiring me to give a lot of time, and I actually can't even quantify how much time. All this going on, I don't have time to deal with the van. And until I deal with the van, I can't do any van life. But, I have a truck. I have a truck with an 8-foot bed. It's a 2019 Ram 1500 Classic. Pretty good camping vehicle, right? And I have a cap for it. And you may have heard me say my plan was that I was going to build out the back of that truck into a camper. And that might still happen. But that unnamed event needs the truck as a truck. So I can't even do a no build because the truck needs to be always in truck mode because I need to move things. So I can't even do that. I have to put it all on hold, and the very earliest I can even start thinking about getting back into van life is in the middle of July, which I guess isn't that far away, but I mean, I'm supposed to be doing van life here, folks, and I haven't actually done anything remote. Well, it's not true. And I haven't actually taken my van out on a trip since last fall. Anyway, I started talking about how people go from vehicle to vehicle to vehicle, and I have done that as well. And this story I'm telling you leads there. I started off with a smart car towing a little tiny tent trailer. That was lots of fun. Then I got the NV 200, which was great and wonderful, but I put so many miles on it that I felt I needed to give it to someone else who will put fewer miles on it so it'll last longer, and I did, and that's fine. Then I got the ambulance. I built it out. I put a lot of miles on that, and it is the least reliable vehicle I've ever owned, and now I have the truck. So what is a solution for all of that that I've told you? What solution can I do that will allow me to go camping again, doing van life under the big tent label of van life? And the answer is, I need to buy a truck camper. Not a cap. Not a no-build cap. Because even that's going to take some time. I'd have to do wiring. I have to do a bunch of things to get that to work. And that still might happen. Because I'm very curious to how comfortable I can make it back there. But no, a truck camper can come in and out of the truck and be ready to go. And I think that's what's going to happen. Now, how do you get a truck camper? Well, truck campers are oddly expensive if you buy them new. You look at a truck camper and you're like, well, it doesn't even have wheels. And you're surprised to see that it costs more than a comparable travel trailer. And it's because they have to be built differently and they don't have the frame that comes with a trailer. You know, these trailers start as a frame, usually made by Lippert, and that is the structure and strength of the vehicle. These things are built from scratch out of wood, usually, sometimes aluminum. The Alaskans, for example, have aluminum frames. And it's a lot more engineering to actually build a truck camper, and they are much more expensive. But I am in a good position here because I have an 8-foot bed on my pickup truck, which is fairly rare, but it didn't used to be. And that means there are a lot of used campers that will only fit properly with a truck with an 8-foot bed that I can buy at a reasonable price. And that is my new plan. I am going to pick up a truck camper for just a few thousand dollars. And that will be my new van life vehicle. I would prefer the van. I don't actually like owning two vehicles. There's lots of complexity with that, but I would prefer the van. I'm just not confident that I'm ever going to get the van into a state where it is reliable enough that I can count on it. Because I just put $1,800 into it in October and then literally didn't drive it. And now I have... I don't know if it's the swirl valves or the actuator. I just don't know. And it's going to cost many thousands of dollars again because that's how this thing... Anyway, I'm not going to harp on that too much. However, that's the plan. And you see this progression here? Vehicle, 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 vehicle. 5 years, five different vehicles. And I'm not alone in that. And I don't think you're going to be alone in that too. Now, I am kind of feel like I'm being forced into this. I mean, I would rather just keep going with the van and put another 100,000 miles on it. That would be my goal. I like the van, but circumstances are saying that I'm not doing that. Remember, in my giant fleet of vehicles, I had a 1993 Scamp, 13-foot fiberglass Scamp trailer. Very cool thing. And you may notice I just said had, because I don't have it anymore, and I will tell that story later. So the reason I'm telling you all this is to set the stage for the chaos that is going to come for me in the next few weeks. I'm going to try to keep up with the podcast. The chances of me missing an episode is pretty good because I have very limited time in which I can actually make podcasts over the next 2 months. But I am going to do my best to do that. So if I miss an episode, I'm sorry. It's just that life is interfering. Also, learn from this. Learn from the stuff I'm going through and what all the other YouTubers are doing. Sometimes people change vehicles because they have come into more money and they want a bigger, better vehicle, and that, you know, is fine. Some people change vehicles because they're tired of compromising with the vehicle they have now. Maybe it's they want to stand up and they can't stand up, or they want to get better gas mileage, so they want something smaller. Or they want to do off-roading stuff, so they want something with four-wheel drive, whatever. The list goes on and on. There's all kinds of reasons. But ultimately, all van life vehicles, let's just say that, all van life vehicles are a compromise. And sometimes you want to switch your compromise. You want to switch space for fuel economy, for off-roadness, or whatever. And I don't think that cycle ever ends. And now you're in it. A big thank you to Terry and Mr. I. Rose, because there are no ads in this podcast, and it's their fault because they went to buymeacoffee.com/builttogo and bought me a gallon of diesel. Actually, bought me 2 gallons, which was very nice, Terry. Because of that, there are no ads in this podcast, and we can just get on with it. If you would like to help keep ads off the podcast, please visit buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. It's 2 T's, not 1, not 3. Also, thank you to everyone who donates every month. You guys are my heroes. I do very much appreciate it. Van life news. Well, some first news is good news. VanFest, my favorite VanFest thing. My favorite van gathering is doing great. Apparently, they're adding more events. So, as you know, they are in Cape Cod this August, and it does not look like I'm going to be able to get to it, and it really bums me out. I'm actually going to be in Cape Cod 2 weeks earlier. Anyway, I can't go, I don't think. I'm still going to try. I'm going to look for a window. But that is happening August 21st to 25th in East Falmouth, Mass., which is the western part of the Cape. Looks like a great event. Now they've added 2 more. One is Vanoween. Vanoween. Halloween in a van. And this is not an expo event. This is like a gathering kind of party, kind of sitting around the campfire, roasting pumpkins? I don't know. But whatever you'd like to do. This is in Apache Junction, Arizona, so quite a bit away. This is in the southwest. And it's October 30th through November 3rd. And that is live now. There aren't that many details, but you can look at what there is and get a pre-sign-up for it on their website. Also, they have announced that they are going back to Florida for Liftoff 2026. This is the van life event that's right on the Space Coast. And the last 2 years, they've seen rockets lift off while they were there, which is very cool. 300 or so rigs. It's a fairly big event. And that is going to happen in early February of 2026. And you can sign up for the mailing list there. They don't have exact dates yet, but that's going to happen. So that's very good news. A lot more VanFest is coming. And I'm thrilled. And I hope to be able to get to some of it, whether it's in a van or a truck or the Wienermobile. I don't know what I'll be driving by then. But I really hope to get to something soon. You can find out more at VanFestUSA.com. Next, this is not good news. This is from the BBC, and the fire department over there, and the fire people will tell you that this is a growing problem, is that e-bike batteries, just as an example, are causing a lot of fires. Lithium batteries hold a lot of energy, and they can cascade out of control, and all that energy is released in the form of heat, and that heat burns things like houses and pets and whatever's around, and it's very hard to put out. And what's happening is a lot of people are buying cheap e-bikes and cheap battery banks and things like that, and they're catching on fire. Most of these are lithium ion. This is less of a problem with lithium iron phosphate, but still, it's a problem. And what do you do? So they're trying to do an education thing where, like, you know, be careful of these things. Don't just, like, plug in your e-bike and then put it in your kid's room and then ignore it. You have to be careful. And be careful, too, that if you damage these batteries in any way, that's really when you're going to get into trouble. The battery itself is in the plastic case, probably, but inside there's a battery. And if that gets an impact, the chemicals can mix and cause a fire. That's why almost all lithium batteries are in these cases. In the UK, they're going to change their laws around this and try to make them safer. But for you, you have to keep an eye on these batteries and try to avoid buying the cheapest possible battery-powered thing, especially if it's a large-capacity battery. I mean, if you're going to buy an e-bike, try to get a good one that doesn't have a cheap battery in it. And always look for lithium iron phosphate if you can. It is a better chemistry, and I hope lithium ion goes away pretty soon. I'll have a little bit more to say about lithium batteries and fires later in the episode. And finally, something that many of you know that I know is that working from home, or in your van, which is your home, of course, can make you happy. At least it makes you happier, in the sense that it leads to a more fulfilling life. So scientists have been studying this remote work thing since COVID, basically. They've had 4 years to look at people who work at home and look at people who go into the office every day, and they have found that people who work from home are actually happier on average than people who have to go in the office. And there's a lot of reasons for that. For one thing, you have more time to yourself. Now, there is also an argument that you work more if you work from home. That's a side thing, but you don't have a commute. And if you live in a big city, that can take an hour or more on either end of your day and give it back to you. And it's a frustrating hour. You know, if you have to commute for an hour in traffic, that does not lead to happiness, let me tell you. So that helps. They also find that people sleep more, possibly related to the fact that they have more time, and more sleep is conducive to more health. And believe it or not, it adds up to a number that you can look at. They estimate, and this was an Australian study, but in Australia, people who work from home have 10 extra days worth of free time per year. It's like 10 free days of vacation, just for nothing. I mean, just because you didn't have to go into the office. They also found that people eat healthier at home because they have much more control over their food. They have all their food with them, so they don't go out as much, they don't do fast food as much, and they don't, like, grab and go as much, and that helps too. Now, of course, there are challenges with this. You know, you're isolated, and you're not having that water cooler chat and all that, but often that is overcome by other things. So the negatives are well overwhelmed by the positives. Hey, if you're an employer, I can tell you that companies can successfully run with a staff that is entirely remote. The last company I worked for had 30 employees, and none of them worked in the same building or even the same state. We were all in the same country. I'll give you that. It worked. The company was completely successful, and any thoughts of like, well, I'm paying them for 8 hours a day, and they better be working those eight. Yeah, that's the wrong philosophy to have. The right philosophy to have is, are they doing the job I'm paying them for effectively? If they are, it doesn't matter where they are. The report on working from home is from the FarmingDaleObserver.com, a huge URL. Find it in the show notes. But hey, I love working remotely. I wish everybody could do it all the time. I hate this trend of everyone going back into the office. But there's one thing about trends, and is that they stop being trends in time. And this just in, as we're going to press, as it were, but isn't. I was a guest host of the podcast Skeptoid this week. Thought it was going to be next week, but it was this week. So that is out now. I'll have a link in the show notes. But you can just ask your fancy device, listen to the Skeptoid podcast, and you will hear my dulcet tones wax on about James Randi, Houdini, and the Million Dollar Challenge, where if you can prove that you're psychic or something, you will get $1 million. And it's real. And you can hear why. Skeptoid. Tech Talk 2019 Ram 1500 Classic. It's the old style of Ram pickup truck. All pickup trucks today, for some reason, have four doors and short beds. It's, people use trucks differently than they used to. They're not just work trucks anymore. They're the family truckster now. Mine is actually an old work truck, but it's a fairly rare configuration of the Ram 1500 with an 8-foot bed. In fact, when I look around, most websites don't even recognize that there was a Ram 1500 with an 8-foot bed in that year. But I have it, so it exists. There's a problem with 1500 series trucks and long beds. So this is, you know, Ford F-150, same thing. That level, like half-ton truck they're called. The problem is that they have a lot more capacity of volume than they have of weight. So I can fit a ton of stuff, literally a ton of stuff in the back of my half-ton truck, but it's still a half-ton truck. I can't hold that weight. I can fit any truck camper ever made on that truck, but the vast majority of them are way, way too heavy, even for my big, bad truck. Also, people now will buy trailers and then haul them around without looking at the gross vehicle weight rating or anything. They'll just hook it up and say, oh, this drives nice. There was one couple pulling a 25-foot Airstream around with a minivan, and that Airstream had a weight of 6,800 pounds. And I don't know of any minivans that can tow 6,800 pounds legally. But they did it. They went all over the country like this. So what's going on? Well, your capacities are legal restrictions. They're not physical restrictions. I mean, of course, if you can tow 500 pounds with your vehicle and you hook up a 750-pound vehicle to it and you step on the gas, yeah, you're going to be able to tow it. But there are situations in which that is unsafe. Braking, cornering, high winds, big hills, all these are factored into this number that is given to the vehicle that dictates how much you can tow. So there's the gross vehicle weight rating, which is the combined weight capacity of your vehicle and what you're towing. There's also payload, which is how much your vehicle can have in it, which includes passengers and gasoline or diesel and all the stuff in the back. And it includes the weight of the trailer's tongue on the back of the truck. You do need to know all this stuff, but that's actually not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is those times when you ignore this. Because you're going to ignore it. A lot of you do, and I have as well. And I wanted to let you know that if you are going to do the not safe thing and overload your vehicles, which I have to state is illegal, unsafe, and void your warranty, you do need to take steps. And also remember that if you are in a crash in an overloaded vehicle, it's probably going to be your fault no matter what happens. So keep that in mind too. But if you're doing it anyway, these are the steps you should take. Okay, first thing you should do is, as much as possible, upgrade your key systems. Now, you can't change the weight rating of your vehicle. You can't go to the mechanic and say, oh, I want to add another 500 pounds of capacity to the vehicle. No matter what the mechanic tells you, legally, you can't do that. But you can do some things to beef it up. For example, if your vehicle has rather small brakes for the type of vehicle it is, you can get better brakes. You can also add trailer brakes to your trailer. That will help too. One of the big problems with towing oversized vehicles is the wear and tear it puts on your tow vehicle, especially to the transmission. My NV200, which I did tow a trailer with, had a tow rating of 0. So did my smart car. I towed all over the country with that. Both had weight ratings of 0. But I did it anyway. You can criticize that for me all you want. But the risk I was taking in this regard to the health of the vehicle was the transmission. Now, the smart car had basically, it was a manual transmission that shifted itself, which is different from an automatic transmission. It was an electric shifting manual transmission, very strange thing. You had to learn how to drive it. No clutch. It was all automatic. But that's a fairly robust and simple kind of transmission. The NV200 had a CVT, a continuously variable transmission. These transmissions are much maligned. I kind of like them because they give a smoother ride and better gas mileage, but they are not good for towing, and you run danger of overheating your transmission if you're towing with a CVT. I did it anyway, and I did start to have some transmission problems, which I was able to fix by changing the transmission fluid, which weirdly is not recommended in this vehicle. You don't change the transmission fluid in an NV200. But I had, I think, cooked my transmission fluid. And it wasn't while I was towing. It was actually, I think I may have done the damage while I was towing. The problem I had was just when I was going up a big hill. Anyway, the point is that you are risking your vehicle. So knowing that, drive slower. You know, that's a big thing with wear and tear and gas mileage, is just how fast you're going. So if you know you're overloaded, drive slower. Also, pay very, very close attention to your tires. Make sure that they're not old, they have good tread life, and they have the proper tire inflation. And if there's a range, you should fill it up to the higher part of the range if you're going to overload your vehicle. You also have to change how you drive. Now, this is second nature to me. I've driven so many vehicles in so many configurations that I literally drive differently depending on what I'm driving. You have to do this if your vehicle is overloaded. You want to start slower, which is probably going to happen anyway. You want to stop a long way before you normally do. And if you're in traffic, you want to leave more space so you have more space to stop, which is a problem in big cities like Chicago, because if you leave any space, someone's going to dart in there, eliminating all that space, and you're going to have to slam on your brakes, and they're not going to stop it the way you think because you're overloaded. You also have to pay special attention to balancing the load, because if you put all that weight in the back, you're definitely going to have a serious problem. And you want to maybe change your route. So if you're in Colorado, those of you who have been there realize that half the state is flat. Okay, that's not where you're going to have a problem. You try to go through Denver and try to cross the Rockies in an overloaded vehicle, you could have a serious problem. And if your destination doesn't require that, don't do it. You can go around to the south and go over much easier roads. And if you had one of these overloaded vehicles, that would probably be a good idea. Next, you want to stop and check and make sure everything's okay as often as you can. You know, every hour, every 2 hours, having an infrared thermometer is not a bad idea to make sure the wheel hubs aren't getting too warm. And then you want to know your route as well as possible. You want to use a GPS that can tell you what lane to be in, like Apple Maps does that, which is great. You want to know where the exits are ahead of time. You want to anticipate them. And then you want to get over in that lane as far as possible. Now, we talked about which lane you're supposed to drive in. In an overloaded vehicle, I would say you should be in the rightmost lane because you should be one of the slowest vehicles on the road. Now, does that mean you should go out and do these things and it's safe? No, absolutely not. It is not safe to drive an overloaded vehicle, and yet a lot of us do it from time to time, or even more time to time. And I'm in that situation now with this truck, because if I get the truck camper that I'm looking at, I will be right at the limit of weight. And that means if I fill up the water tank and put in lots of food and fill up the gas tank and add another couple lithium batteries like I like to do, I'm probably going to go over that limit and I will adjust what I'm doing. So, take my advice and don't do this. And then when you do, take my other advice and be a little bit safer. Product review. Product review. Going back to the battery problem, the lithium battery problem, I thought, well, you know, they have battery boxes for lead acid batteries, and they will have a vent in them because lead acid batteries, obviously not safe as well. They give off hydrogen gas, which is, you know, explosive, and that's not a great way to make water, by the way. And so you have to put them in a box and vent them. And if you look in your van, if you have the battery in front of the front seat, like Sprinters and Promasters do, and maybe Transits, I actually don't know, they're also vented. If you look in there, there is a vent. So what about lithium batteries? I mean, if these things can catch fire, shouldn't we put them in something so that if they do catch fire, it won't be so bad? And I thought, you know, that's a product that should exist. And I looked at, yeah, of course it exists, and it's cheap. And now it's so cheap, I'm like, yeah, everyone should have one of these. Now, the one I'm going to review here is called the Z Fireproof Battery Pouch. There are many. I have not tried this thing, so please don't think that this is the one. It's just an example, and the reason I said it's called Z is because it's spelled Z-E-E-E. So I'm assuming that's how they want to pronounce it. It is the Z Lipo Guard. Yeah, they probably translated that from Chinese and don't realize the other meanings of lipo. This device does not suck. No, wait. All right. Too many metaphors. Put that aside. What this thing is it looks like a lunch bag. It's the shape of a normal car battery. It's that shape with a handle on it, but it's a bag. It has a little door in the side or a little flap that you can open. It closes with Velcro. And what it's intended for is not necessarily for putting your main leisure battery in, although you can do that. It's for charging all your other stuff. So let's say you had an e-bike. You would take your e-bike battery, take it out of the e-bike, put it in this bag, and then run the charging cables through the flap and charge it in this bag. And then if it caught fire, the fire would be contained to this bag. And the thought is that the fire would burn in here, and then the gases would build up in the bag, remove any oxygen from the equation, and it would go out. And the bag is made out of a material that can handle 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, to be clear, 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit sounds great, but these fires can be hotter than that. This is a safety feature. It doesn't make things completely safe. So please don't think, well, now I don't have to worry about it. No, you still have to worry about it. Also, it has a handle on the top. So if this something starts happening, you see smoke coming out of the zipper of this thing, you can pick it up and take it outside very easily without having to touch anything. I mean, you have to touch the bag, but you don't touch the batteries. Now, how much does this cost? Well, it's $15. It's actually $15 with discounts. It's a save 10% coupon and a save 15% coupon, depending. For $15, it seems to me to be a pretty easy element of safety. And I think if you're charging batteries in your van, lithium batteries, you should probably have one of these, just to be safe, especially if you're buying cheap batteries. So I'll have a link in the show notes. Again, it's called the Z Fireproof Explosion Proof Large Capacity Battery Storage Guard Pouch for LiPo Charge and Storage. And yeah, if you have a bigger 200 amp hour battery or whatever, that's not going to fit in this. This is much smaller than that. But take a look at this and then look at all the other ones, and you can be a little bit safer. Tales from the Road. So I have a good story. It's a bittersweet good story, but it is a good story. So the Scamp, right? I have had the Scamp for a while now. I purchased it from a friend who got it under unusual circumstances and didn't really have a use for it. So I went and picked it up and brought it back to Tiki Bagelland. And then over the last few years, I've been fixing it up and changing things and making it a better camper than it was. And I took it out to Colorado on a big trip, and it was great, and I love it. It's a, scamps are really nice campers, and they hold their value, and it's because they're simple and solid. So you can buy an older scamp, and you can renovate it yourself, and you'll have a solid, excellent vehicle. And that's what I did. But, again, you've heard me say 100 times I have too many vehicles. So my plan was that I was going to fix it up even more and then sell it. You know, and just, you know, see what happens with it. And then someone I knew who has come with me on some of my trips said, hey, that scamp there, huh? You thinking of selling that? And I was like, well, yeah. And she said, well, I might be interested in that. And I was like, well, okay. And then I had my surgery and everything got complicated. But we were able to work something out. And I want to tell you this story because this is not a normal man sells camper to woman story. This is, I wish there were more stories like this. So, she lives in Indiana. Scamp is in north central Illinois. And I said, well, why don't you borrow it? Now, I know her, and I was totally comfortable with her just literally borrowing the scamp and seeing if it's what she wanted. And she plans to travel a lot in her retirement, and this is her vehicle for doing that. She bought a new tow vehicle. I thought, okay, this would be great. She can try it out, and then if it doesn't work, it's fine. She can just bring it back, and I will continue with my plan. But the very first thing I did, because it was all I could do, this is way back when I was barely walking, is I took a video of it. It was a terrible video. I couldn't get the protocol right, and I ended up using the camera in the wrong mode. And this is what I did. I showed her every single thing I could find wrong with that scamp. Now, this was after the winter. It had been sitting for months. I hadn't touched it. I hadn't dewinterized it. It was filled with ladybugs. There was dirt and leaves. It looked its absolute worst. And I showed her every single wart and flaw. I made that thing look as bad as I possibly could to make sure that it was still what she wanted. And even after I showed her all that, she said, yeah, I would like to take a look. So we went back and forth a bit, and we arranged that she would basically come camp with me at our campground in Tiki Bago Land, as I call it, in the scamp. She would bring her tow vehicle, and she would just dive right in. And then if at the end of the weekend she still liked the scamp, she would buy it from me. Now, I hate talking about money. I hate talking about prices. I told her this, and I told her this is how much money I would like to get from this vehicle, and she said okay. And that was the only discussion we had about money. And I thought, okay. Now, the business folk among you might be thinking, well, he probably could have got more money, and there wasn't much I don't care about any of that. I wanted mutual solution of problems. She needs a camper, and I need a camper to go away, and I need some money for that. That was it. As long as all that was met, this was a perfect transaction. So we spent the weekend in this half and half mode. I would leave her alone so that she could experience the scamp entirely by herself, because I think that's important. And I would come over and work on things with her. So she said, well, I'd like to do this. I'd like to put a 12-volt socket here. So we put in a 12-volt socket. We did it together. I did some. She did some. We talked about the door, because scamps have this weird door problem where the door pops open. And she bought basically a folding railing or folding handle that can keep the door shut. And we put that on, ran into some problems, solved them together. Just basically went over the entire thing and fixed anything we could. And anything that was a bigger project, we talked about. For example, the tires are 6 or 7 years old and they're worn. They need to be replaced. Trailer tires need to be replaced more often than regular car tires. If you're not aware of that, they were ready to go for the scamp. And she said, that's fine. I've made an appointment. I'm going to take care of that. And it was a lovely weekend. It was fun. We got to hang out. She got to experience all these things in the scamp. She got to see if this was for her or not. She got to fix things she wanted to, ask the questions she needed to. And I know this isn't possible with everybody. Of course, every transaction can't be like this. But it was nice. It was fun. And yes, I was a little sad to see the scamp going down the road. And I was also a little sad that my friend was leaving, but I get to see her again in a couple weeks, so that's fine. But wouldn't the world be nicer if everybody had a story like that? If the vehicle that you bought, you went and hung out with the guy or the girl and, you know, you drove around a bit and you stopped at the mechanic and talked about things, and there was utter and complete honesty between both parties. Wouldn't that be great? It's such a rare thing that I was really happy to have been able to experience that at least once. Because the worst thing that could happen in my mind is if she buys this and she doesn't want it, or she buys it and isn't aware that, I don't know, there's a crack in the fiberglass or whatever. I mean, I showed her every flaw. That would be terrible. I would feel terrible about that. And feeling terrible is not something I want for me or her. I just relate that story to let folks know that sometimes it doesn't all have to be about getting as much money as possible for a thing. Enough is enough. And all these billionaires you hear about all the time, you have something that they will never have, and that is enough, or at least the capacity to get there. A place to visit. 1975, which, oh, it was only a few years ago. Yeah, all right, 60 years ago, I was a child. How could it be 60? 50 years ago, I was a child growing up in Massachusetts, which I will remind you is where Jaws took place. And in fact, Jaws had taken over and had scared the entire world, first through the book and then through the movie. And every single kid I knew that year was terrified of not only the ocean, but rivers, ponds, lakes, and swimming pools. I love the movie. It's a very well-made movie. There are a lot of issues with that movie in that it has demonized sharks, which are not anything like what's in the movie. It's led to a lot of shark deaths, etc., etc. Putting that aside, if you had told myself as a 9-year-old or an 8-year-old summer of 1975 that I could go watch the movie Jaws in a giant swimming pool while sitting in an inner tube at night, I would have said, no, thank you. And yet I would absolutely do that today. And, well, there's a way to do it. Because Jaws on the water is a thing. You may have heard of the Alamo Drafthouse. I guess they're a big franchise now. They're everywhere. But they didn't used to be. But they are now. And they are putting on Jaws on the water in San Antonio, Texas. And it is exactly like I described. For $35, you head out onto the water. They have this giant pool there, and you just sit there in your inner tube with a few hundred of your friends that you may hope are tastier than you, and you watch Jaws. And I imagine that is just an amazing experience. I mean, I have not done this, but the photos make it look really, really cool. I mean, imagine a flooded drive-in, and you're floating in a flooded drive-in in an inner tube, watching Jaws. Now, this does not happen all the time. They only run this on certain dates. This year, it's Sunday, June 7th, Saturday, June 21st, Saturday, July 12th, and Saturday, July 26th. Tickets start at $35, and I have a link in the show notes where you can get tickets and stuff. Again, this is in the San Antonio area. It's actually at the Valenti Beach Resort and Water Park, which is in Leander, Texas. I hope I pronounced that right. Apologies if I didn't. Ooh, and of course, it's one of these things where there's fees and junk, so it starts at $35 and then they add fees and stuff. Realistically, it's going to cost you at least $42 to do this if you bring your own inner tube, and if you don't, it's going to cost you $65. But I think it's worth it, especially if you can bring someone who's never seen Jaws before. Bring a camera. Put it on TikTok. I want to see. Anyway, very cool thing. If you can do it, I think you should. But yeah, Jaws on the water. And I'll have a link in the show notes. Resource recommendation. You may have heard of Little Free Libraries. I used to have a Little Free Library. They're fun things where people put in books, take books. There's been controversy about them too, because there's controversy about everything. However, some people have said, hey, you know, books are great and all, but what people need is food. So what if we had little free pantries? And in fact, we do. You can find out about these things at littlefreepantry.org. Now, for van life folks, I see a couple of possibilities here. First, some van lifers are having a struggling time. And if you're struggling with food security, these are for you. Absolutely feel free to roll up to one of these things and, you know, grab a can of beans, a box of pasta, whatever's in there. And that's great. That's what they're there for. They're there for you. But there's another use for van life people. And that is, let's say you go out on a week-long trip and you've got all this leftover food. You don't really know what to do with it. Drop it off at a little free pantry on your way back. Help somebody else out. Now, I will tell you some things about food donations. The big pantry places will accept food donations, but they don't want them. They'd rather have money. They can do more with money. They can make a dollar turn into $5 with the resources they have. So if you just want to help people get food, don't donate food. Donate money to a major food pantry. That is the best way. But if you actually have food that you're not going to eat, you might as well give it to someone. The secret is that food's expiration dates is not a real thing. I mean, sure, food changes over time, but those expiration dates don't mean that, you know, oh no, this expires tomorrow, and if I don't eat it today, I will die! No, that's not how it works. The food quality will gradually go down over time, but when I volunteered at a food pantry, they said that any food that was within 5 years of being expired goes on the shelf. Because it's food. It's still food. After 5 years, there's some questions, and that's the safety margin. That's probably good for 7 years, but they had to build in a safety margin. So 5 years is it. So if you have some expired cans of soup, yeah, go ahead and put them in one of these pantries. People can decide for themselves whether they want it. The line here is that you don't want to put in any baby products that are expired. Even though the rules are probably the same, that gets risky, and I know at one point somebody donated something like 40 cases of expired baby food, and we just couldn't use it, and we actually had to literally throw it in the dumpster. So that one, don't do that. But yeah, any kind of canned food, anything that's non-perishable, or heck, even if it's perishable, if you happen to have a whole bunch of apples that have some shelf life left, go ahead and put them in there. So there are a bunch of them. They're all over the place. This is a fairly big phenomenon. And I have seen a few of these, and they tend to get emptied out pretty quick. So there's definitely more of a demand than a supply, which is hardly surprising. Whichever end of it on, it's worthwhile that you know about it. So that's littlefreepantry.org. I will have a link in the show notes. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 259. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you need to get a hold of me, good luck. No, I'm sorry. If you need to get a hold of me, you can send me an email at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. An email is definitely the better way to get a hold of me, at least for the next several weeks. Until next time, remember the words of Dwight D. Eisenhower, who said, "Plans are worthless. But planning is everything."